If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Today on RCR Greenwashed, we've got a very special guest. His name is Harvey Week, and he has had a long history in the petrochemical industry. He's a chemical engineer, Canterbury University trained, long history in the methanol industry, I suppose, with Methanex, New Zealand and globally. So welcome to the show, Harvey. We're grateful to have you on. It's a big subject. We hear lots of things in New Zealand at the moment about let's get to net zero. There's a whole lot of people have a whole lot of opinions. Very hard for the mums and dads and the people paying the bills to understand exactly what's going on. So with that very lightweight introduction, could you sort of fill in the gaps? Where did you come from? Where were you brought up? And what made you get into the petrochemical and chemical engineering sort of side of it?
Well, thanks, Don. It's a privilege to be on the air. And, I was born in Waikato in a place called Taupiri and raised on a dairy farm and went to St. Paul's in Hamilton and then from there to Canterbury University. Joined one of the big projects called the New Zealand Synthetic Fuels Corporation at Motunui. When Motunui was first envisaged, when I joined, it was just a chicken farm and I was only the eighth employee. So we were sitting at the top of the TSV building because that was our digs at the time. I spent, my career in, Australia, US, Canada, Singapore, all over the place. And I retired from Methanex in 2016 after looking after the manufacturing operations for a number of years. Very exciting, very interesting. But one of the things in the methanol business is you have to really have a lot of understanding around energy and how methanol interplays with all of the other forms of energy. Natural gas supply, what's going on with the oil markets, what's going on with coal, what's going on with renewables, what's going on with technology, how do they interplay, what are the opportunities and threats, all of those sorts of things. So, I gained a really quite an interesting sort of set of perspectives, which I thought maybe I could share a little bit of that, a glimpse of that, with the listeners of RCR.
Well, that's exactly what we need, Harvey, because there are so many disparate views out there, and it's vital we have specialists such as yourself to tell the story accurately and, without too much, overt self-interest, which seems to be the case with a lot of people we have contact with.
Yeah, sure.
And so, look, just go back to the beginning, though. Think back was when, mid-70s, mid-1970s, early 80s, is that right?
Yeah. So it really started at the end of the 1981 election, and when the Taupo seat swung national the next day, I was offered a job. So this is in December 1981. And the Think Big projects, Motunui, petrol gas, or the petrol gas methanol plant, the ammonia urea, Marsden Point expansion, electrification of the main trunk line from Tikawiti or somewhere like that, all the way down to past Taihape or somewhere. The Clyde Dam, there's just a huge number of big projects. And Motunui at that time was the largest methanol facility in the world by a long shot, and was really set up to in concert with the Marsden Point expansion, was designed to increase New Zealand's self-sufficiency in energy, transport energy, by 50%.
Gee. And so it must have been a massive boon for the Taranaki economy, let alone New Zealand economy.
Oh, yes. Very, very significant. So, you'll see that it shows up in the infrastructure. Pipes in the ground, water pipes, sewage pipes, footpaths, the state of roads and bridges. I mean, they're all in fantastic condition in Taranaki versus other parts of the country. So there's a massive amount of capital injection that went into the province associated with the Think Big projects.
And so, I said we wouldn't fast forward too quickly to today, but I'm going to for this one question. What's our energy mix like and our energy security like in this country? I mean, there's discussion that I hear that talks about how we're not that sort of resilient. We don't have a lot of supply backup if something goes wrong in our fossil fuel delivery, for instance. What sort of security, energy security, can we really bank on in this country?
Not a lot. We're gradually unwinding all of the features of the New Zealand economy that we've enjoyed in the last 30 years and taken for granted. But I can tell you that the moment something goes wrong, whether it's an off-spec delivery of jet fuel to the airport, it shows up very, very quickly and it's very significant. A lot of the things that we ignore, or most of the public really don't follow and not particularly interested because it all works. But the moment it doesn't work, it's the only thing people talk about. So yeah, it's a big deal. I thought it might be useful to try and help the listeners. You know, I can try and join the dots between the cost of energy and the cost of living crisis that we're all experiencing today.
Yeah,
so
well, that's,
I could keep going if you'd like me to.
Yeah, no, yes. Absolutely, please.
So a number of chemical engineers a few years back basically developed a global energy model. And the reason a global energy model versus a country energy model is that it's difficult to do that for a country because of all the invisibles, all the profits and all of the trade that goes on. It's very hard to account for all that. But when it's global, you've got everything captured. So they've got a global energy model. And it's broken up into two parts. One is the energy sector, and the other one is the main economy. Now, the purposes of, and this will apply equally to New Zealand as it does to the globe, but it's been done for the globe. So the energy economy has a series of primary resources going into it, things like oil, gas, coal, uranium-235, ore, wind, solar, hydroelectric water or water and lakes, solar and wind, all of the, biomass, wave energy. So you add up all of the forms and you've got basically a group called non-renewable and a group called renewable. But those resources in their own right are not useful to our society. We can't do anything with them. We have to spend capital to convert those into a form of energy that's useful to us, like electricity, like petrol, like diesel, like LPG, like bitumen for the roads, like CO2 for bottled gas for our beer. So there's a number of different final products that come off the front end of that resource. So the energy sector has a capital requirement to convert the resource into usable form. Now, that usable form then enters the main economy as an energy source, whether it's power or gas or diesel or whatever it is, okay? It goes into the main economy. The main economy is basically all of the rest of the economy, excluding the energy economy. So that's all the goods and services of the country or of the world. Basically, it's all of the goods and services produced. So this includes your hospitals and your schools and your bridges and your tunnels and all of the thousands and thousands of commodities and materials that we enjoy to achieve our standard of living. So all of that is called industrial output. So now once you've got that industrial output, some of that industrial output has to be siphoned off to feed the energy economy. Right?
Yep.
The rest of the what's left over is basically accumulated funds, right? And we can think of the accumulated funds as GDP growth. So it's a bit like throwing a ball up in the air. You know, the ball is either going up and only for a second is it stationary and then it's coming down. It's the same with a growing economy. It's either growing or it's shrinking. it's very rare to be precisely zero. So you really want that feedback into the industrial sector, into the industrial economy, the main economy, to be a positive vector. You want to have funds accumulating in the main economy, right? So what we do with the energy sector is we measure the energy efficiency of the capital deployed. We call it energy return on investment. Now that's a bit of a, it's a variation on ROI, which is used by economists. You can model projects on that basis, but we call it energy return on investment. So for the lay people, think of it as a wealth multiplier. The bigger the number, the greater the amount of value that then passes to the main economy to enable the main economy to do all sorts of things, like HIP operations and educating your children and providing for the police and buying all the things we enjoy. If you don't have that energy vector going into the economy, you've got no economy. There is nothing. Nothing. You've got to have a vector of energy going into it. Right. So you measure the energy, you measure the capital efficiency in the energy economy by virtue of the wealth multiplier. Now, I'm not going to explain the model any further than that, but suffice to say that historically, the number has averaged maybe around 70. So we've got a 70 multiplier on the capital that converts a resource into outputs that are useful to us. So for instance, when we built the hydroelectric dam system in New Zealand in the 50s and 60s and built Marsden Point in the 50s and 60s, when we did that, we got a multiplier of more than 70. And fundamentally, that's underpinned why we New Zealand has the standard of living that it has for 5 million people. If you didn't have low-cost, continuous and reliable energy, you haven't got an economy. You can't do anything. So our forefathers that committed to building these big projects across the, you know, the Waitaki Power Scheme and Clyde, and I mean, it just goes on and on. It's just so much. We all take it for granted. But that multiplier was about 70, roughly. Okay? So back in 2010, the OECD countries started to embark on a set of policies to tackle climate change. They introduced all sorts of things. Each country's done different things at different paces and different scales. Some have got a carbon tax. Some have got an emissions trading scheme. That's what New Zealand's got. Some have got feed-in tariffs for basically guaranteeing a power price for the renewables. Some have got other penalties associated with fossil fuels. New Zealand banned the oil and gas a couple of years ago. All really designed, effectively, to try and achieve a reduction in our carbon footprint as a country, as each country in the OECD world. And the key objective in more recent times is this concept of called net carbon zero by 2050. So a very noble objective, shall we say. And so that's driven by investments in wind and solar and transport electrification, plus the idea of planting a lot of trees. Now, trees that are exotic, not native, because native is a sink and you have to retire the land. If you plant pine trees, you get an income off those, thank you very much. So you clip the ticket on the way through. People forget what happened 20 years ago when the tree matures. So these are the sorts of changes that the OECD world has embarked upon for the last 14 years, roughly.
And so just going to that multiplier, you talked about the 70, was that sort of an industry sort of benchmark that seemed pretty appropriate for the time? And
it was the typical multiplier, like oil, original multiplier for oil was 400. And for coal was like 200 or 300, so massive multipliers. So, but and hydro is more like 70. So if you take the oil, gas, the fossil fuel sector, plus geothermal, a little bit of geothermal, so there's only a few countries that have got it, plus hydroelectric power, that's the bulk of the mix. And that gives, over the last, many decades, it's probably about 70. It could be a bit higher than that. That includes your natural gas, etc. So what we now need to think about is, okay, so if we've got a real fixation on introducing renewables, what are we talking about? So if we look at all of the range of renewables, the only two renewables with today's technology that can meet the scale of requirement for humankind is solar and wind. However, the multiplier for solar is about 10, and the multiplier for wind is about 20. But in both cases, they're not continuous. So for the intermittency, who covers the cost of when it's not blowing and when it's not sunny? And at the moment in New Zealand, we pass that, well, the power companies pass that internally to say, we've got plenty of hydro installed capacity that the taxpayers originally built. We've got plenty of that spare capacity. We've got a little bit of firming capacity on Huntly to fire up on coal. We've got the peakers and Taranaki that run on gas. We're really hunky-dory. Everything is fine. But as you increase the level of intermittency, the capacity, the size, or the scale, or the proportionality, there's no free lunch. You're giving up some flexibility that the grid has always enjoyed. And we've never really had big rolling blackouts. We've not experienced that for decades. I don't ever remember it, actually. But if you keep introducing an intermittent supply and you run low on water, at a time when you have a drought, you often don't have any, we don't have much wind because you've got anticyclones over the country. So you've got two whammies at the same time. So you've got a different risk profile. So who bears the risk? The power companies or the consumer or the country? So if you factor in the intermittency, then wind has a wealth multiplier of somewhere between 8 and 20. And solar has a wealth multiplier of somewhere between 2 and 10 compared
Wow.
with 70. So you say, well, so what? What does that mean? What does it mean for the average citizen in the country? What does it really mean? This is all very academic and very esoteric. What it means is that you're going to end up with a lower standard of living. And you say, well, no big deal. Okay, so in order to understand the scale of this, we need to take a bit of a history lesson and go right back to 1800. So in 1800, before the age of coal, and it's illustrative only, right? This is not a mathematical exercise. Every 100 people in the town or a village, 35 out of 100 were required to collect, cut, dry, and haul firewood from the forest to the town, to the village, to the house, to burn it for heating and burn it for cooking. There was no middle class. You either had the landlords that owned the land, or you had the peasants that did all the work. And life was miserable, and it was in survival mode only. Not much else for anything else. That's all you did. So 65 out of 100 did everything else. So when the age of coal came along, that ratio dropped to about 12 from 35. Now, the implications of that, because coal has twice the energy density as wood of wood, so you ended up having all this released energy into the economy. So guess what happened? For the first time in humankind, we created a middle class. That was when the middle class happened, because we had this surplus energy that all of a sudden we didn't need 35 out of 100 doing all that work. We only needed 12. So the gap between the two was the formation of the middle class. When oil came along at the turn of last century, that went to six. So 94% of the population could do everything else. School teaching, lecturing, and, you know, running businesses, doing all sorts of things, you know. So you know, having holidays and enjoying the life where you come to know, right?
Aside from having a longer life expectancy as well all that time. Yeah.
So as a consequence of having more energy, we had more children. So the population rate of the world, the changing population, follows the fossil fuel story. So as the fossil fuels increased, we had more time to have more kids and et cetera, et cetera. So the population has grown with the capacity to grow more food and burn more energy, right? So now we sit on a ratio. Well, remember that ratio, wealth multiplier from that energy model, that energy sector, yep. The wealth multiplier was 70. So on the same illustrative basis, you've got six people out of 100 dedicated to the energy sector on a 70 multiplier. When you go to an 8, or pick your number, somewhere maybe 10 multiplier, yeah. All of a sudden, you lose a bottom chunk of the middle class to poverty. And there's nothing a government can do about it. Government policy settings, tax settings, social settings, you cannot alter that fundamental. It's driven by the energy and the cost of energy. And you can't fix it because it's like the laws of nature. You can't change physics. It is what it is. So to provide an example, so people say, well, you know, energy is, you know, running my car, or I want to decarbonize by 2050. That's no big deal. Carbon is everything all around us.
Yeah.
So if you look at the cost of food production, so your primary crops in the world, so rice, wheat, barley, corn, half the cost of production and delivery of food to you as a consumer, 50% of that cost is fossil fuel in the form of, you know, ammonia, urea, fertilizer, you know, pest control, weed control, processing at the factory, trucks going from A to B, trucks delivering it to your supermarket, et cetera, et cetera. All of that trail, it's about half the cost of delivered food is the cost of energy.
Yeah,
when if I look at construction materials, if you want to build a home, where does MDF come from? You know, your flooring. So MDF is basically pulp of wood, and natural gas. Natural gas converts to methanol. Methanol converts to formaldehyde. Formaldehyde converts to formaldehyde resin. The resin is used to make MDF. Same with plywood. Same with any reconstituted furniture made from wood. Okay. Yeah, aluminium windows comes from an aluminium smelter. Most of the aluminium supply in the world is made from obviously smelting bauxite, but you need copious quantities of electricity. Most of the world's power comes from the burning of coal. So, and so it goes on. Glass is made from silica. You mine it. You don't use sand off the beach. So silica is mined, you add coal, concrete, you know, you take your limestone, you calcine it to calcium oxide, you add a few other extra odds and sods, you react it with water, mix it with a bit of aggregate, and you've got your concrete. But it takes enormous amounts of energy to produce concrete, same with carbon steel. They've all got, all I'm illustrating is that carbon's everywhere. And so it's either in the product as embedded, either in the product as a carbon structure in the product, or it's embedded from the making of the product. But either way, virtually all of your construction materials used today has got a carbon footprint, you know, huge.
That's interesting. So isn't it,
if you took all of the cars in the world off the road and turn them into electric vehicles, you drop the CO2 emissions by about 9 or 10%. It's so small. The real emissions is all the things we make and the food we produce. So are you willing to lose your cell phone? Are you willing to you lose, cell phones made from natural gas? It just goes on and on.
But that is the question, isn't it? I mean, you began, Harvey, by talking about the Think Big projects. We've come now to a stage where we have many government bureaucrats working as part of this organization called Degrowth Aotearoa. And they are talking of tradable energy tariffs and tradable energy quotas and saying that we need to degrow. So suddenly, the virtue signaling from a country at one time thinking big, being proud of being energy reliant, we've reached a stage where living in penury, being destitute is almost virtuous now. You hear people talking about, I've got an electric car, or we'll have children marching soon. They march every year to save the climate. But are they actually thinking, like you said?
If I keep going a little further, you realize that, okay, the picture is even worse than that. I'll keep going because it's, I've talked about all of the things that are embedded, all of the carbons embedded in all the products we use, right? And so if you put a little circle around New Zealand, you say, well, okay, so, New Zealand looks really good. We're carbon neutral. Okay, all we've done is shift the carbon load to another country. Nothing's really changed unless we're prepared to not have cell phones, not have TVs, not have comfortable sofas to and beds to sleep in. It just goes on and on because, foam rubber and you name it, everything virtually has got fossil fuel in it, one form or another, because methanol is a precursor from natural gas. Methanol goes all over the place. It goes into making sports equipment, goes into making cell phones, it goes into making TVs, it goes into making tertiary water treatment plants for sewage treatment. It goes all over the place. So it goes into all your medicines. If you want to have paracetamol, and it goes into chicken food. If you want to have any chicken, any egg that you consume anywhere in the world, unless it's truly a chicken out in the searching for insects, you add methylamine to that, or amino acid into the meal. That meal comes from, the additive is methylamine, which comes from methanol, which comes from natural gas. Everything is linked up. People don't understand the scale of what's going on. So if I look at, so what I want to do is just talk about why is it that those renewables, the wind and solar, is so low. Why is that multiplier so low? Because you'll hear people with a counter argument that says, oh, solar's coming down in price and
More
wind's coming down in
efficient,
price, they're very competitive. Okay, it's an illusion. So what's going on here? First of all, you have to think about the cost of energy. You've got the resource itself. So obviously wind is free. We don't pay for wind, as I understand. Then you've got the materials and labor to convert it into power, right? So when we look at the materials, what we're really looking at is the metals, minerals. So things like copper, nickel, manganese, and there's about 20 of them, right? So if I look at the, so when we say, what's the alternative to that wind turbine? Well, the alternative to the wind turbine is a gas turbine. So you have a power station running natural gas to produce an output. We call it a gas turbine. So if you put in a 100 megawatt gas-fired power station, you get 100 megawatts. If you put 100 megawatt wind turbines, 100 megawatts worth of wind turbines, you'll get 40 megawatts. If you put 100 megawatts of solar panels in, you'll get about 15 megawatts of continuous averaged over the year energy. So how much extra minerals is required to make that wind turbine per watt? It turns out about 18 times more minerals or more metals per watt of power. But it's worse than that because it only runs 40% of the time for a wind turbine. So it needs nearly 50 times more metals or minerals per kilowatt hour of energy produced, compared with a gas turbine. If I look at solar, the multiplier for solar is about 10 times the amount of minerals or metals required to make the solar panel. It's silica and all sorts of stuff in there. Okay, but you, because it only runs 15 out of 100 time, 15% of the time on average in New Zealand, that translates to about 80 times the amount of minerals per kilowatt hour. So clearly, we're too far south, too far away from the equator for solar to make any sense at all in New Zealand. So wind is the best of the two renewables for New Zealand. Okay? But it's a 50 times metals requirement. Right. So if you've got 50 times the and by the way, an SUV, a mid-sized SUV, is about 5 times the metals requirement compared with an internal combustion engine. Okay, so if we're really consistent about all this, we would be turning around because it's, you know, we're in a green transition. We'd be happy to provide all of the mines in New Zealand to dig up the nickel and the copper and the manganese in New Zealand to produce these materials for the wind turbines and solar farms. Okay, so when I look at the scale of everything in the world that is grown by humankind and mined by humankind, that total is around, round numbers, about 100 billion tons a year, of which 15 billion tons is all your fossil fuels. That's your coal, your gas, and your oil. 15 out of 100, right? Metals represents about 10 billion tons of rock you have to get to mine to get, you know, 130 million tons of metals that the world uses, right? So if you're going to have 50 times the amount of metals for renewable power to replace your fossil fuels, you can see that the world quickly, you know, we're going to end, it doesn't compute. Nope. The amount of mining that you'd have to do is just goes off scale. We've never mined this much stuff in our lives.
And we are at the stage where we want, you know, the earth to be untouched, pristine, and all of the environmentalists,
it's not
the simplest
reality.
Thing, we can't do that. Yet mining, because it's not happening on shore, like not far from where Dawn and I live.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Yep, we've got coal reserves here that we could use, clean burning coal, but this country seems to prefer, coal from Indonesia, not quite the same quality. But I guess what happens is the emissions are not counted in our national inventory, and that's all that matters, doesn't it?
Yeah, so when we go back and look at the core objective, what was the core objective way back in 2010 for the OECD world? You know, all of these different, I've lost track of all of the,
Started off
with the Kyoto Protocol, and then anyway, so the last one was the Paris.
Paris Accord.
So, you know, really, they've had that many meetings. But the core objective, presumably, is to reduce CO2 emissions globally, right?
To control the climate, yep.
So that's the premise.
Yeah.
So
but
CO2
the premise,
emissions,
ultimately, it's not just CO2. They say we can control, we can manage our weather, you know, more consistent weather patterns.
let's just put that to one side and say, okay, we want to, the objective is to reduce CO2.
Mm.
Well, we're not reducing CO2. So CO2 is rising at the rate of between 1 and 1.5%. Even today, with a very, very weak world economy, we're still growing at 1 to 1.5% per year. So by the end of this year, we will have passed 40 billion tons of CO2 production generation off human activity. So the net effect of spending trillions of dollars in the OECD over the last decade and a half has been what? What have we actually accomplished? What we've done is deindustrialized the OECD. We've shifted that industry to non-OECD countries who have got aspirations to have the same
standard of living
everyone else has, which is fine. So we've transferred the carbon load to these countries. Deindustrializing, of course, is going to be a consequence for us all. And what's the consequence? Well, we've got quite expensive energy, by the way, and it's not ever going to go away. It's relentless. Governments can't fix this. The only way they can actually fix it is to bring in a set of policies to focus solely on all energy being available to the economy that is low cost, continuous, and reliable. the same as it always has been, the same as in the 1950s and 60s. And you know what? By doing that, like I'm on the same page as the CEO of Toyota, you know, forget about the EVs, focus on the fact that the hybrids actually, vehicles actually drop the CO2 emissions by about half. Man, that's a pretty good start. Going from nothing to halving it, that's a big improvement. And it uses what we've already got. You know, you've got all your infrastructure, you've got your petrol stations, you've got tanks, you've got your pipelines, you've got your, all of the infrastructure is supported by, you know, using Prius vehicles, for instance, you know.
So having, it's pretty easy to see all this in front of us. Why is it that the people in authority can't see the damage that's being created every day by their policy? Why can't they sort of say, look, we need a reality check and a bit of a wake up here. We're making our country poorer, not richer.
Not sure whether very many people turn their minds to this. Everyone's busy with their lives. Busy, busy, busy. I've got to answer my emails. I've got to do this. I've got a meeting tomorrow. I've got to, you know, it's the motion of work, right? You're not actually generating any change in the structure of the economy. You're not actually generating wealth, but you're doing a lot of emails. There's a lot of chatter. There's a lot of noise. There's a lot of noise. Okay. So and the institutions in Wellington, you know, they take a bit of a lead. And don't forget, you know, the academic institutions across the world, across the OECD, have got quite a lot to answer for because, you know, we're originally tasked with improving our standard of living. And they're churning out individuals that are not thinking so much about a lot of these issues and what it is that they can do to make a big improvement. So we're focused on a single narrative, which is, well, we've got to reduce our CO2. Okay. And the problem is, A, we're not achieving the objective, and B, we're wasting a lot of money. And when the technology, because I don't believe we have the technology today. No one wants to hear that. But yeah, we don't have the technology now. It's not wind and it's not solar. It's too flaky. It's too intermittent. You've got to have something that's 24/7. It's either fusion or it's likely thorium fission reactions. You know, so that would be my pick is thorium, but it's still a long way away. Now, that technology was developed in the US in the 1960s, but the fast breeding technology was much cheaper at the time. So, you know, lots of hurdles, lots of challenges to overcome, but thorium is everywhere. It's in the soil, it's in the oceans, it's all around us. So you can just dig it up and just, you know, so that technology is in front of us. Now, when we want to ever use that technology to get a major breakthrough, we need capital. But guess what? We've just wasted all our capital and now all we have is debt.
Massive debt.
And we've run out of choices. We will not have any choices because we're going to spend all our remaining funds servicing a debt. So, you know, my advice is keep the powder dry, get your debt down, do sensible things that leverage the current economy, the current infrastructure. For instance, hybrid cars that are just got a little small battery in them, with and it improves the fuel efficiency, particularly around town. It doubles the fuel efficiency. For trucks can run on methanol and diesel, a mixture. You have a tank on one side for diesel, one tank on the other side for methanol. This is what they're doing in China. I have no idea why we don't do that here, but anyway. So, and that drops the particulate matter, you know, the pollution that comes off it, the atmospheric pollution, drops that dramatically. It drops the NOx, drops the SOx off the, and drops the carbon footprint. Obviously, you've got a carbon footprint associated with making the methanol in the first place. But these are practical steps that have a meaningful effect on what's going on. If I look at the Methnex fleet of tankers, a very big proportion of that, I think something like about half now, run on 95% methanol.
Mm-hmm.
No one knows about it. So these are things that you can do with existing structures around us. Okay, it doesn't get us to zero, but nor will all any of these things. They won't get us, they won't even change the dial.
No, they won't. So, when you look at failing infrastructure, what have been, as you said, we've been left with this massive debt. Our hospitals are not functioning like they could. The lesser said about our roads are better. And I don't know, Don, whether you have an opinion on what are your hopes from the new coalition? Are they going to deliver on, you know, everyone said there'd be oil exploration and natural gas and everything. Do you pin your hopes on this?
Well, you're asking me that, you probably ask Harvey. But my personal opinion is with their credit card maxed out, or you know, the country debt profile being so precarious, I know you can always find more cash, but at a certain price, I'm very worried about it. As I think I'm deducing from Harvey's feedback or input here, is that, you know, we actually haven't saved enough cash for the big ticket items that we need to invest in. And yeah, I think there'll be a bit of reluctance to
In most of this case, New Zealand will be a technology taker, not a technology maker. So the technology for energy will come from abroad, from, you know, big organizations are spending billions on this area. So, and then we'll be able to buy, you know, the plug and play power station that's got a local fuel that we can use. So, but it's a little way away as yet. And the thing is that we'll need capital to do that. Now, this is all happening against the backdrop of a world that's, how shall I say, the average age of the world is getting older. Mm-hmm. So the birth rate's been low for most of the world for the last 30 years. So our big issue of our day is not CO2. CO2 is going to fix itself because once the boomers move on and the cost of capital starts to rise, again, not because of what governments or central banks are doing, it's because there's less of it because of the shape of the population profile everywhere. Okay, it varies from country to country, but even in places like India, we're now below the replacement birth rate. So these are big, big trends that are going on, and they will play out. And so when we say, okay, we're going to be exporting to all these different markets, well, so is everyone else.
Yeah.
So we're all trying to export into a smaller and smaller slice of the pie. So I have no idea how that's going to play out, but we do need to have a resilient economy at that point. And we need to have the ability to take action and take options. So if you go back to the original Think Big projects, that was all about the inability for New Zealand to get its hands on oil. We could not get our hands on oil after the second Arab crisis because it was being diverted to other countries. We couldn't buy it. We had carless days. So you couldn't drive your car on the weekends, and one day of the week you weren't allowed to drive your car. And we had little stickers, if you remember.
Yes, I do.
And they all had different colours for each of the, depending on which sticker you had. My mum and dad, we couldn't drive on a Tuesday and the weekends. It was only emergency services could drive on the weekends. And fundamentally, that was our life. And you know what? The government turned around and said, well, we've got this natural gas resource. Let's turn it to a transport fuel. Let's improve the resilience of New Zealand against that shock. No one saw that shock coming. No one's going to see the next shock coming, but it will come.
It will.
Well, I think we've had part one of Harvey's story. What do you think, Jaspreet? We probably need to get Harvey back and get part two because this is a massive story.
Absolutely. From one time, you know, talking about energy resilience, we've now come to a state where all the country talks about is climate resilience. Somewhere a reality check has to come in about what do we need today.
You need to get food on the table.
100%.
So you think of Maslow's laws. You need security, you need shelter, you need food, you need warmth.
Yeah.
And if those are compromised or threatened, that whole concept about the environment goes out the window. You know, you go to places that are a little bit less well off than New Zealand, the population's not thinking about these things. They're just thinking about getting ahead, get the kids educated so they can have a better standard of living than mum and dad. And it's, you know, going from survival to a better life. We're not thinking like that.
Well, if it's any consolation, Harvey, I used to talk about this just about all the time in speeches, that we use the environment every moment of every day to various degrees. And most people don't even realize that. Everything is too simple. We've become comfortably numb, as a term I use, to what is around us and the politics that are in play. We've sort of accepted that there is people in authority that are making these good decisions for us. But
well, I think,
now that I'm a bit more cynical.
This is not unique to New Zealand. You can go all around the world and see the same thing going on. So I think it'll play out a little further yet. But at some point, there's a reckoning. You either run out of cash, you run out of capital, you run out of customers. You run out of a tax revenue base. There's going to be some very brutal decisions that governments will have to be faced with. So my view is that governments around the world won't get to 2050 before the set of policies that have been put in train are going to be reversed. Not because they want to, it's because they have to.
Society
will get to a point where countries become unstable and governments will get kicked out until such time as someone listens to the people.
Yep.
And cost of living is only the canary in the mine here. And it's relentless. It's year after year. It's not going to get better until you fix these issues.
Yep. We've had previous guests talk about the cost to New Zealand in the next few years, let alone to 2050, and they're eye-watering. We're aware that the former Prime Minister pledged $30 billion of our cash. I'm not sure where it's coming from, around the NDCs. And so remind me what they are, Jasper.
Nationally determined contributions to the Paris Accord. Yep.
I always have the brain fade on that. And it's amazing. These people think money grows on trees. And, in the same time, you've been a farmer, son, Harvey, farmers aren't as revered as we need to be. Miners aren't as revered as they need to be. People doing real production systems aren't as revered as they need to be. So someday, we're going to have that reality check. And I think you're right, Harvey, it's going to be any time soon because we've certainly borne the brunt for many years. In fact, I would go on to say the enacting of the RMA in 1991, followed by the Kyoto Protocol and then the Paris Accord, is just tied us in knots that we didn't deserve. And I think we're paying the price, but maybe
there's a context here, but I don't want to really end on such a downer because a chap by the name of Hans Rosler, he wrote a book, what's the book called? He wrote a relatively, a brief book that's only probably 100 pages long, and Factfulness, I think, Factfulness. And in the answer, I think there's something like 12 questions at the beginning of the book, okay? And what he's correlated the responses across countries and socioeconomic groups and professions. What that book reveals is that the people with the least knowledge are the people with the highest level of academic achievement. The people with the highest level of academic qualification are the least informed people. The people with the highest level of knowledge are people that use their hands.
Yeah.
Farmers, tradespeople, people that actually live and work their hands and interact with real people.
Yeah.
Not behind a desk. And so, it's not the poorest people, it's not the wealthiest people or anything like that. It's really to do with, and so, it's a very inspiring, it's a very uplifting picture because it tells us that the reality that most people face is much, much better than what you believe it to be based on what you read and watch on TV. What you see in the mainstream media is more doom and gloom than the reality. So it's not saying that there's, it's better than it is in reality, and we still have problems to solve.
But, you know, mankind has, we have always overcome this. The human spirit has always overcome issues. And
absolutely.
I would agree. Some of these.
And we will, because you can't con everyone all the time. You'll eventually, most people will twig on to the fact that there's something wrong, fishy that doesn't make any sense. So what I've tried to do here is at least join a couple of dots for people to understand that energy fundamentals is beyond, you know, mucking around with capital gains tax and mucking around with, social equilibria or whatever, you know, trying to, you know, help those that need a helping hand. That won't fix it.
No.
That's only, you know, very glossy. So you really have to get to the fundamentals. And what I've tried to describe here is the fundamentals as it relates to our energy systems.
Well, and you've done a great job of that. I think, Harvey, we will have to draw it to a close, but we would really like you to come back and talk a little bit more about New Zealand's energy security and anything else we can sort of think about around how New Zealand's future can be made more well, we would like our New Zealand future
optimistic.
To be a bit more uplifting and optimistic. Yes, thanks, Jaspreet. Yeah, we would like to be able to talk about something that's a bit more uplifting than, as you say, the doom side of it. So, look, if we could get you back in the next month or two, we'd really be honoured. But in the meantime, we've been graced with your presence today and we really enjoyed your topic. Boy, that took us to another level, didn't it, Jaspreet?
It did. It's not often we have somebody with 3 decades of petrochemical industry experience in the house. So we're very grateful to you, Harvey, today.
Oh, no problem. Right. And I wish you guys well.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much.
Okay, bye-bye. Cheers. Bye-bye.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.